Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today is Paul Taylor, Chief Executive Officer and Discretionary Fund Manager at McCarthy Taylor, and personal finance writer Kate Bearley. In this week's Portfolio Clinic, we feature a property consultant who wishes to retire in 3 years and whose portfolio is fairly biased towards house building shares and property. This has done well for the REIT until now, but he isn't sure what to do regarding the composition of his portfolio going forward. Now, Paul, you were one of the experts who reviewed this. Looking at investors in general, first of all, who've had a good run of house builders, what should they do next? You know, what's the outlook for house builders going forward?
It's quite a difficult one to call because there are competing factors. Obviously, there is a shortage of housing, and so there's a great deal of demand. And when there's demand, you'd expect people to do reasonably well. However, the contacts I have in that industry are suggesting to me that the period of real accelerated growth is coming to an end and things are beginning to flatten out. There's a difficulty in getting development land, partly because developers are, to a degree, holding on to it in the hope that values go up, and partly because of planning issues and just lack of opportunity. And that obviously puts a bit of a brake on things. Plus, house builders need skilled labour, and there's a great shortage of skilled labour, and that's going to put up their costs and narrow their margins.
If the Bank of England raises interest rates later this year, as some people think might happen, will this have an impact on house builders and UK residential property?
We're not expecting interest rates to go up significantly for the foreseeable future. So to start with, probably not. It's probably not going to make much difference to a lot of people. But as time goes on and the interest rate rises are compounded, then possibly it will start to slow down demand. It's probably not as big an impact as it could be because of the help to buy schemes and so on that have been offered by the government. But over time, the impact of interest is bound to slow the market down.
Yeah, now we've been talking about residential property. What about companies related to commercial property? What can we expect from them going ahead?
Well, in the same way that property is all about location, 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 it's also about what type of commercial property and what the covenants are like, the type of tenants that you've got. We all know of town centres where the offices, there are shops and offices standing empty. But in London and Birmingham, for example, there's extreme demand for office space because a lot of office space has been converted into residential property. So it's very much a patchy thing. We like commercial property funds that invest in large distribution units because we've got a big switch towards internet shopping, and that requires distribution units. And we think, on the other hand, with manufacturing struggling still, there's not going to be so much demand for industrial units. So it's a question of looking under the bonnet and seeing what kind of commercial property you're looking at buying through a fund, or if you're doing one directly, you've got to choose very carefully what you're buying.
Paul, what would be some examples of funds that have a focus on distribution?
Well, we're a big fan of the Tritax Big Box Fund, which has been a very successful fund for us. And that's certainly one that features largely in our portfolios.
Yeah, that's a real estate investment trust, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yeah.
But it specialises in distribution units. So it's right in the sector that I'm talking about.
Yeah. Now, regardless of the current macro situation, what sort of percentage range should investors, let's say, limit their property equity exposure to?
Well, property, of course, has a lot of advantages in the sense that if you've got a good quality property portfolio, it produces nice, steady returns. The downside is it's also very illiquid. So if you want to take your money out, it can be quite difficult to get money out in certain circumstances. So we tend not to have a very large exposure to property in our portfolios. We tend to have, for the more low-risk investors, about 10%. And for those that are looking for more growth and less stability, 5%. So it's in a range of 10% if you're a low-risk investor, up to 5% if you're a less-risky investor. I know it sounds inverse, but we see property as a lower-risk holding within an overall portfolio.
Yeah, presumably high-risk investors could look to more equities or other high-risk
assets. Yeah, greater equity exposure in order to get greater growth.
Yeah, okay. Now, the reader featured in the portfolio is actually of a property background. If someone has, you know, specialist knowledge, particular sector, for example, because they work in it, do you think that could justify them having a higher weighting to that sector?
I have a number of clients in the property industry, and of course, having that kind of expertise does give you an edge, and that can't be denied. And if you see an opportunity and you can use your expertise, of course, that's something you want to do. However, there are dangers associated with it. For example, if you're income and your business and everything else is all to do with property, then all of your investments are to do with property. You're not giving yourself a place of safety in the event of something going wrong. If property starts to get into difficulty and things start to go wrong, you won't have anything to fall back on. An investment portfolio should be something that's there to provide a fallback position when your working life or your business or whatever starts to get into any difficulty. It's something you should be able to fall back on. You can't do that if it's in the same sector that you're working in. You're putting all your eggs in one basket, to use a well-worn phrase.
Okay.
There's one other thing as well. I find that people who invest in the same industries in which they're working have a risk of being overconfident. They become over-convinced of the sector they're working in, and it's like being too close to something. You don't always see the risks coming until it's too late.
Okay, yeah. So how could this reader here and other investors diversify their portfolios if they need to cut back exposure to house builders and other property-related equities?
Well, my view, there's a couple of things that they could do. If they're looking for something similar to property that isn't directly property, then an infrastructure fund, which invests in government contracts and so on, as most people will probably realise, that gives you a similar type of return to property and has the same illiquidity problems, but it is something you can use as an alternative, as a proxy to property. The other thing I would say is, at the moment, with volatility being so high, it's a good time to hold cash. We're expecting at some point gilts and bond yields to rise as the value of those fall, and that could give you an opportunity to start buying gilts and bonds at more appropriate yields. We're not expecting yields to go back to where they were a few years ago when the 10-year gilts were on a 5% yield, but we are expecting at some point yields to get back to 3%, and that could make them more attractive as a safe part of your portfolio.
Okay, so you say cash is justified at the moment, let's say, certainly as a short-term hold.
I certainly would. I think we've got a lot of volatility at the moment. We've got the Brexit, the referendum on UK membership of the European Community. We've got the US elections in November. We don't quite know what's going to happen there. I mean, heaven forbid that a certain person should become president of America. It would scare us all a bit. And we've got the Middle East conflict coming up. We've got terrorist activity. We've had the bomb today in the Far East. It's one of those times when you're not quite sure what's going to happen next. So that's going to cause a lot of volatility because markets don't like uncertainty. And all these political issues are uncertainties. The economic fundamentals might be fine, but if you get that political uncertainty, the markets will be very, very volatile, and that creates opportunities. So if you've got cash and you can see an opportunity because gilts in rates and yields fall, rise rather, or if you see a particular equity holding that's looking very cheap, if you've got cash, you can take advantage of those opportunities.
Okay. Are there any other kind of portfolio smoothing assets you could have at the moment in view of all this potential turbulence?
Well, I'm a very much a nuts and bolts man. I don't go in for complex financial products. I have a tendency to believe they're designed more to benefit the institutions that promote them rather than the investor. So I'm very much in cash, bonds and gilts. At the moment, the bonds and gilt prices are too high to get a decent return from them, and we're a great believer in being in equities. But in terms of equities, we're out of the FTSE 100 because it's a global market invested largely in mining stocks and oils and financial stocks. So we prefer to be more in the FTSE 250, which is a broader index, giving us much more diversification and less risk.
Okay. Now, this reader has nearly 40 holdings. Most of them are direct shares, with the exception of two, which are investment trusts. Now, for a direct shares portfolio is, let's say, whatever, 35 to 40, is that a good number, or, you know, what would you suggest?
Well, it could be if you were investing in one market and in one sector, as I was just saying about the FTSE 100 being so heavily based on global mining and oil stocks and financial stocks. The danger is that your concentration is too great. You see, if you buy a decent tracker, like a Vanguard FTSE 250 tracker, you get exposure to a much larger number of holdings for the same amount of money. So the danger with having just 40 holdings is that you're still going to have insufficient diversification and you're going to be overexposed to a particular market. The UK isn't the only place to invest. You know, you need to look broader around the world as well. You want to get more diversification in geographical sense, and using collectives enables you to do that. I would have preferred to have about 50 positions if I wanted to be in the UK alone. Then you start to get near the same sort of diversification and risk management we achieve through collectives.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Some useful suggestions there. Now, Brazil, Russia, India and China, the so-called BRICS, were a key area for investors, but more recently emerging markets have gone out of favour and have been engulfed by problems including volatility and a collapse in commodity prices. However, the BRICS still account for a considerable portion of the global population, and some would argue cannot be ignored. So, Kate, you've been looking at the investment case for each market. Turning to China, which has been very much at the eye of a storm, can you tell us a bit about what's been going on and what effect it's had on funds focused on China?
China has been having a nightmare since the start of the year. It's a domestic market, which is very driven by retail investors, so it makes it incredibly volatile anyway. And at the moment, they're driving some incredibly volatile behaviour. It's kind of a combination of some bad domestic data, so people being worried about this shift from an investment-led to consumption-driven economy and how that's working or not working, and what kind of slowing Chinese growth would mean for the rest of the world, because it obviously has big implications. So people are worried about that. And then the government has been kind of tinkering or intervening quite heavily in the market consistently for the past few months. And actually that's worrying people because it seems a little erratic and the extent of their involvement is making people worried. And no one really knows what's going to happen next. I mean, at the moment, things like whether or not a big ban on share sales by large investors, whether or not that ban is coming to an end, is making domestic investors unsure of whether they should get out of stocks or not. And generally, people are just very nervous, both inside and outside China, of what's going on in the market and what it means for the future.
Should UK investors still consider investing in China?
I wouldn't say, definitely get out of it, and definitely don't get out now, obviously, because it would be a bad time to exit your holdings after they will probably have taken a bit of a beating. I would say there's a difference between the headlines coming out of China and investing as a UK investor, because the worst of this news is very focused on the domestic market, which actually we can't access as UK investors. We access different shares. And so those are less hit by these kind of by the worst of this news. So there isn't a sense that, we should definitely not invest in China, but it is a bit of an unnerving place to be right now and a bit of an unpredictable one.
Paul, do you think China's an area to be avoided?
Well, I entirely agree with Kate's remarks. I think she's absolutely spot on. I wouldn't avoid China, but I think the question is about it's about the degree of risk an investor is prepared to take and the amount of exposure they're going to have. China is the second largest economy in the world. It's developing and changing and developing, just as the US did once, and it's likely to overtake the US in time. So for an investor taking a long-term view, you want to have some exposure to that market. But I think your exposure needs to be very modest. I think you need to keep it down to 3 to 5%. And that way, if things don't go particularly as you expect, it's not a big proportion of your portfolio.
Okay, and do you advocate single country China funds or, let's say, broader regional Asia funds?
We tend to go for more specific China funds rather than broader Asia. We tend to treat them as separate areas in our portfolios. We also like India, which we think has a tremendous amount of potential. So in a lot of our portfolios, we'll have some China-related stocks and some India-related funds.
OK, Okay, which takes us on to the other three. Kate, you've been looking at them as well. What is the situation with the other three BRICS, Brazil, Russia and India?
Well, yeah, I guess you've got to divide those really into where things are looking pretty horrible, which is Russia and Brazil, and India, which is a little different. So in Russia, we've obviously got the low oil price, which is really impacting the economy. Obviously, it is a market which is pretty much based not entirely on oil, but to a large extent on energy, oil and gas. So this $30 a barrel oil is obviously very bad for Russia, and they are trying to kind of restructure the economy, but it's taking a long time. And then you've got all of the geopolitical tensions surrounding Russia, which will continue to weigh it down and make things very unpredictable and unnerving. So Russia funds having a terrible time in recent years. I mean, in fact, over 2015, there was a slightly interesting quirk where many funds and the market did better than many other emerging market funds and returned a positive amount. But that was mainly due to the ruble and the dynamic there. So definitely not something to look at and think, oh, Russia's doing okay, because I don't think it is. And then in Brazil, you've got Dilma Rousseff, president, facing calls for impeachment, which is pretty dramatic. And the country's in a dire recession as well. Incredible political uncertainty there. And it's going to be very hard to turn that around. So in terms of Brazil and Russia, they're looking distinctly unappealing. But India, a bit of a different situation. People feel quite positive about India. It's got a very good narrative, both in terms of demographics and in terms of what Narendra Modi is trying to do, turning the economy around, making it more focused on manufacturing, and really making India, you know, a kind of growth engine of the emerging world. And people really seem to have faith in that. So I mean, what I've done in this, in the article, is actually break the BRICS down and say, right, what's the cheapest, what's the riskiest, what's the most expensive? And when you look at that, cheapest by far, Brazil and Russia, you can get those at really low prices, kind of a discount to the assets they hold. So, you know, I guess you could look at that and think, over the long term, you know, maybe that's worth it. But they're also by far the riskiest, which I guess is no surprise.
So it's a reason why they're cheap.
Exactly. Yeah. And then on the flip side, least risky has actually been India, but also definitely the most expensive. And it's been the most overhyped. So I don't know whether, you know, that might be a bit of a concern going forward. The market did rally a lot when Narendra Modi came in, and it's kind of tailed off slightly since then.
Paul, you said you liked India as well. Do you think it's too expensive, though?
Well, I think for a long-term hold, no. I think over time it's got a long way to go. It's a very underdeveloped economy still. I think it will grow and grow and grow. I think the danger with Russia and Brazil is that they're very linked to commodities and oil, which, of course, are not really in demand at the moment. I think in the short term particularly, the pricing reflects the fact that they are very reliant on those commodities and that's reflecting in the prices that you're getting for those holdings.
Do you think investors should totally avoid Russia and Brazil?
I personally don't think they justify the risk. I don't see the long-term gain personally. But I'm a very, a very, very sceptical investor. I like to see why I'm investing and how I really feel that the country is going to develop and whether there's big political risks. And I think there are large political risks still in Russia. I mean, we haven't forgotten that Russia invaded the Ukraine and that's still bubbling away in the background, and they've got problems on their Chinese border with the Chinese and so on. And as Kate was saying, you know, Brazil has also got some political difficulties.
Okay, well, some skepticism is always healthy, I think, when investing. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much indeed. Speak to you soon.
Speak soon. Developed markets have been doing a lot better than emerging markets, but last month there was frenzied selling in one particular area of the US, the high-yield exchange-traded fund market. Panic was triggered when a credit fund said it was not going to allow investors to take the money out. Kate, first of all, why did the fund stop investors taking their money out, and why did this cause panic in ETF markets?
Well, yeah, this fund announced that it was stopping investors taking money out and was winding down. And it was due to concerns over whether it could buy or sell the high-yield bonds, the junk bonds underlying it, at prices which weren't going to be too damaging to current shareholders. So, I mean, this is obviously people's worst fear, that you buy something and then you can't get out of it when the market is tanking. And in terms of why this caused kind of wider panic in the ETF market, well, for a start, I mean, in fact, saying that, you know, there was this massive spike in trading is not necessarily equivalent to panic. I mean, ETFs are used a lot as a kind of short selling mechanism. And so we'll come on to the kind of the dynamic there between people wanting to get out and people actually buying it, using it as a tool. But obviously there were concerns that if this fund was having such problems with its underlying holdings and being able to buy and sell them and the value of these junk bonds, people are thinking, is this going to be an issue for my ETF as well? Because, you know, obviously they're holding similar things, or that's what people were worried about. And the idea of, actually, you want to sell your ETF, but the ETF provider can't sell the things that you hold, that's a worry. But in fact, those kind of fears are unfounded to a large extent, because we're talking about very different things here. This Third Avenue fund, this mutual fund, is very different to an ETF and all of the ETFs dealing with high yield bonds. The Third Avenue Fund, it was dealing with very distressed debt. Some debt wasn't even rated. So it's very high risk and quite an abnormal style of fund. And the thing to remember about ETFs is that because they're listed, they're much more liquid than other mutual funds. And normally, if you want to sell your ETF, someone wants to buy it. And the provider doesn't need to then go and buy and sell the underlying holdings. They just need to, you know, give you the ETF that someone else has sold on a very simplistic level. So in fact, this isn't something to worry about with ETFs, even though it did cause this big spike in trading.
So are high yield bond ETFs then something investors could consider at the moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, another thing to say is that obviously this was in the US, this bit of news. And the US high yield market is very different to the European high yield market. And actually, people are quite, or managers and analysts seem kind of cautiously positive about European high yield. It could benefit from European recovery. Credit quality tends to be kind of reasonably high, so there's not that fear. And actually, it's quite cheap at the moment. So, yeah, some people are quite positive about high yield, but it's obviously a bit of a volatile area.
Okay, so something for perhaps high risk appetite, long-term time horizon investors.
Yeah, and just very different depending on, you know, US, European, depending on the kind of high yield you're looking at, I guess.
So picking the right one as well. Okay, thank you, Kate. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. So it just remains to thank Paul Taylor, Chief Executive Officer at McCarthy Taylor, and Kate Bailey. You can read more on allocating to property, the BRICS and ETFs in this week's Investors Chronicle and on the website. Thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.